This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi for more information. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi.
If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store, you're going to see the 2016 Partially Examined Life calendar featuring the ultra-cool artwork of Sterling Bartlett. The second thing, songs from the Partially Examined Life. We've ordered a limited number of CDs. Lastly, we've created some other kinds of merch, including a very nifty Nietzsche mug. Thanks and enjoy the episode. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 130 is something like, what is biological life? And we read books 1 and 2 of Aristotle's De Anima, usually translated as On the Soul, from around 350 BCE. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, focusing mostly on my nutritive functions in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, both form and matter, in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwyn, completing myself at the Monaco Hotel in Washington, D.C.
This is Dylan Casey, being fully myself in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Wes, your intro sounds like the beginning to a crime novel.
It does it? At the Monaco Hotel?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this will be our last one posted of the year, and we should take a little time. Well, first of all, we have the opportunity to slow down a little bit here if we would like, because we're going to spend 2 full episodes. That is, for you non-citizens, 4 postings, 2 full dialogues, 2 full discussions on this book, De Anima. Basically, to talk about the biology in the first half and then the psychology in the second half, though that really doesn't break down that well that way, as I found as I got into it. And in fact, he wrote a whole bunch of other books on zoology that are sort of more directly, like, if you wanted to say what is Aristotle's biology, you would not necessarily talk about this, but still we can spend some more time just kind of talking about the weirdness that is Aristotle's way of talking. So because of that, we can, anything we don't get to today, we can just push off to next time, and that's fine. So maybe we should start by, I have a couple viewer mail things I could read. We haven't done that forever.
Yeah.
I'm dying to hear that.
Okay, you're not going to like the ones that I picked, but I had a purpose in something I wanted to say in reaction to them. So the first one was a comment on our blog, on our Hayek podcast, actually, recently by Ariel. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you'll recognize it as soon as I start it. I love you guys and love the podcast. In theory, in practice, less. When you don't understand something, you defer to authority, which is normal, but normal is the problem. Philosophers should do otherwise. Hayek is a propagandist for fascists and corporations. People in life have no place of priority to those who paid for this propaganda. Blah, 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 blah. You should be better, unless you are also trying to please your corporate sponsors. Congrats on making some money out of this, but please keep it real despite your success.
We can summarize that email saying, you did not seem to have the same strong political opinions that I have. And seeing being the operative word, because we might. I mean, we didn't indicate what our opinions were. We well might have our opinions.
So, yeah. Yeah, and that was common for the Hayek episode, right? I wasn't even on that. And the emails that we got from people were pretty amazing.
I would like to point out that although we post our episodes and say, oh, we're doing an episode on this person or that person, we are always reading a text. We did not do an episode on Hayek.
Yes.
We did an episode on the use of knowledge in society, which is eminently readable and very reasonably positioned or argued.
Good point.
And it may very well be that he wrote The Road to Serfdom, right? And he was very pro some things and very anti other things, but they didn't come up in that article. So go back to the text.
So let me read the second one, which is a different tone, just because really my response to them both is the same. Elizabeth writes us a letter. Hi there. I'm a rather infrequent listener, but I find the podcast very helpful. I'm a graduate student, and I usually check in when I need a refresher or I'm cruising for a paper topic. I was pleased to see the recent podcast on the human condition and have it in my queue, but the presence of Hannah Arendt suddenly put into stark relief how woefully, capitalized, unbalanced this podcast is. Woefully! Exclamation point. Asked, how did Jaspers end up with a podcast before Hannah Arendt? I thought I would offer some suggestions. Simone de Beauvoir, Judith Butler, bunch of other women that I've not heard of. Also, maybe while you're at it, you could do some post-colonial theorists and list some of those. Philosophy is a living, breathing entity. Perhaps the podcast would benefit if you opened the door and gave it some air.
Very eloquent.
So that's a very common thing. And actually, we kind of responded in our Q&A to that, you know, why don't you cover more women? So go listen to that if you want the answer to that. I'm not going to bother to repeat that. But the common theme between these two is you're not forwarding my political agenda. And I have a problem with that. I guess my summary response is,
we don't care about your political agenda.
Well, it's true. So this, obviously, two different things here. One person just wanted us to be more stridently liberal. I mean, if you listen to us and don't think we're liberal in general, then you haven't listened very much. We considered recently, should we have political ads when we're getting advertisers? Should we have ads for Democratic politicians? Or, you know, certainly we wouldn't have Republican politicians covered. But, and we decided not to, because I think philosophy is great in that you're zooming in on questions that are might not be on the top of people's minds, that it's trying to add an extra dimension to life. So I don't see a lot of value in piling on any kind of issue that is the issue of the day. Yeah, of course, we have opinions on those, but we're not going to do a whole episode right now on how bad gun violence is. That's pretty obvious. Gun violence is bad. We should have common sense gun control. But like, and we don't feel the need every time an issue like gun control or anything was brought up to like make sure we're pressing that point as if we're assuming that the people that we're talking in sound bites and we don't want to be taken out of context because we kind of assume that people are listening to a 2-hour conversation at least, that they have some context. Also, like Seth said, when we're reading the Hayek paper, we're reacting to the specific things that are being said in that paper and the ideas in that paper. And actually, that's what's lacking in society now is attention to what people actually say, not just like making sure that you have the right political branding and are flashing that forward at all times. So I think a lot of us individually have political axes to grind that usually they're ones that we don't think are getting enough attention in the world today. So if we talk about alternatives to the job system from me or the problems with identity politics from Wes.
Dylan feels very strongly about the blending of whiskeys and scotches.
I'm against blending.
Wow.
I've thought a lot about this whole...
it's fucked up.
We get this criticism a lot or the suggestion a lot that we should cover more minority authors, more women authors. And yeah, it sucks historically that women and minorities were excluded from this tradition, that if they were writing brilliant things 300 years ago, they were probably ignored and we don't even have their texts anymore. Or if we do, it would be a matter of doing archaeology and trying to uncover things that were not lauded at the time. But given that our mission is to kind of take apart what makes up our ideologies and viewpoints, it's the things that actually were influential for whatever reason, unjust or just, that are the things that we're most going to be interested in. So I completely sympathize. And it's interesting that the person who asked about, you know, why don't you cover more women and why don't you open the door and give it some air, as if there wasn't like a crazy amount of diversity in the people that we cover just because they're white males. Like if you think Hillary Putnam and Hayek are talking the same language, literally or metaphorically, like you're crazy. There's just a crazy amount of diversity in the history of philosophy. And that's what the identity of politics.
I think I may have been a bad influence on you, Mark.
Well, it's an aspect of that. And it's the same, you know, we have plenty of women that come on as guests, but it's the sad state of philosophy now that 80% of our audience is male. And at least that many in terms of the people that contact us as potential guests are male. So the fact that we have so many women on, we're actually picking a greater percentage of women among those who approach us or that we know than men.
Let me speak to this issue. So first off, let's distinguish between the mission that we may be perceived to be on, which is to cover the entire broad swath of intellectual history, both Eastern and Western, for the edification of our fans, and us trying to do justice to our own interests and our own experience in this limited format that we have, right? So we do what we know. And when we don't know something, but we feel like we need help or we feel like we would like to have somebody who's got more awareness or expertise or knowledge in an area, we invite them on. So if somebody comes and says, you should do more of X, that person should be ready to say, and here's specifically what you should do, and I will do it with you. Don't tell us to go fill in gaps without giving us a path to go fill those gaps in. We don't have any moral objections or any objections to looking at Edward Said or Lusa Rigore, but we don't have any access to them. We don't have an egress point because none of us have any experience with it. So I think that's part of it. The second thing is, I'm not going to invite women onto the podcast just to talk about feminist issues. If somebody wants to come on and talk about Aristotle or Kant or Plato, and they happen to be female or transgendered, whatever, I don't care. But it just happens that, of course, typically people who study and put their time on race issues or gender issues happen to fall into a certain kind of category. So again, though, the same thing, make a suggestion, give us some access point that we can go after it. And then the third thing is, there are certain parts of philosophy that are discrete. So you can read a modern analytic paper on the philosophy of language. You can trace the origin and the genealogy of responses to that paper, and it's a discrete problem that may be trying to be solved. Typically, the oppositional or the areas of philosophy that touch oppression, gender, race, typically don't have a kind of discrete dialogue that doesn't engage a broad variety of sources like Hegel and Marx and Fanon, right, and these sorts of things. So it's not always easy to just pick up Marine Lover of Friedrich Nietzsche and read it together and make heads or tails of it and do it justice. All of those things are impediments, but they're not something that we can't overcome. We just need more constructive advice and support from the community and less criticism.
Well, do you see it as part of our mission to right this historical wrong of these groups being neglected? And so we should, in our coverage, be promoting that, you know, anybody that we cover now, so many people will have heard of Hillary Putnam that had not heard of Hillary Putnam before. Shouldn't we be bestowing that largesse more widely? Or is that not something we should be concerned with?
No.
No.
No, we should be reading things that are interesting to read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This isn't a, it is a charity of sorts, but it's not that kind of charity.
Well, but this brings up a good point. We've constantly talked about what we do and why we do it, and then what our obligation is to, if there is any obligation to the fans. Do we have an obligation to take, for example, let's contrast what we do with what Peter Adamson is doing. Do you guys know who he is?
History of philosophy without any gaps.
The history of philosophy without any gaps. He's taken it upon himself to do, it's a shorter form than this, but it's still very extensive, and he's not leaving anybody out. That's what he's there to do. So yes, you know, he's been doing this for years, and I'm not sure he's even gotten to Descartes yet. The question is, do we have a mission? Are we here to educate the audience about figures, both popular and unpopular, known and not known? Or are we here to do something that's of interest to us, that we hope will be of interest to others, or both, or neither?
I think the pedagogical aspect is sort of secondary. I mean, obviously, one thing we do is try to set some context for what we're reading and try to not assume that people have read the text and so forth. But in general, the idea is what the letter said, which is that philosophy is a living, breathing entity, and the conceit is that these books are living, breathing entities, at least the ones that are really worth reading. And we spend time reading them. And the main thing is the conversation that we have about them. And that is the part that shows that there's living, breathing life in them.
I agree that the pedagogical aspect is secondary for me. This to me is more like performance art.
I guess what I'm saying is that I don't feel like we have an axe to grind about a particular philosopher or philosophy or a particular agenda with respect to either the history of philosophy or the political aspect of philosophy. I think if there's something that I feel like we agree on is, roughly speaking, the engagement of philosophy in terms of trying to know ourselves and the world better. So if anything, we have something like, roughly speaking, a Socratic conceit, even if we don't always agree with Socrates. We want to know, and we find that the activity of conversation is one of the best ways in which to unearth and enunciate what these texts are saying. That by saying it ourselves, it matters. It makes it clear to ourselves and clear to us as a group, and hopefully clear to other people, what we are saying and what the texts are saying. It has the virtue of that activity and not necessarily a political agenda, and likely not even a sociological agenda, other than conversation is good, which is really kind of wishy-washy.
That's a significant political agenda right there, the fact that... And that's podcasts as a whole. We're certainly not alone in trying to press this, but when in other forms of media, a talk show means somebody comes out and talks for 4 minutes and pumps their recent movie, there's a lot of room for other formats. So
it certainly would be the case that if we were in the middle of a fascist regime, that the activity that we do would have deep political significance. And we would have to guard our identities and move from house to house in order to record and publish what we do. That is absolutely true. So in that sense, we are in principle political because we are partisans of both rationality and open conversation.
What I infer from what you just said, Dylan, mm-hmm. is that we in fact do not live in a totalitarian society.
We don't.
Fascist society. Okay.
Well, to return to the previous issue just for a minute more, I do feel somewhat of a mission in terms of this unfortunate, overwhelming majority of white males in the profession and all that. And insofar as we can do a little bit to help address that, then I'm happy to make that one among many priorities that we have. Though an idea was given to me, I'll attribute this to Maisha Cherry, one of the new podcasts that I discovered this year, new philosophy podcast, was called the Unmute Podcast. It's described by her as, we call it Unmute because we want to give a platform to people on topics that have been silenced. And so that sounds like entirely like one of those identity politics sort of things. And she does have some episodes on that. But actually, the way she discussed it on the first episode was just philosophers at all. We don't think of the white male academics or academics in general as having been silenced. I mean, they have a public forum. They have credentials and all this. But the fact that philosophy is so roundly ignored in our culture that just our covering Hillary Putnam is giving a voice to a, well, was he silenced by some sort of a pernicious force? The pernicious force of anti-intellectualism in America, perhaps. So there you go. Does that work?
That works.
Shall we turn to this... unfortunately, silenced voice. I mean, he died quite a long time ago, and most of his books were destroyed, so we only have a small amount of them, and they're not even really books. They're his lecture notes, we think, although I read something that said, well, they're way too organized for that, so I'm not really sure that that's true anymore, but Mr. Aristotle, he didn't even get a last name. That's how oppressed he was. De anima.
All right, I have a question to start. How come we don't typically call this by its Greek name or use the English?
Perisuke.
I'm just curious because I know we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the Greek.
I think it's because of what happened during the Middle Ages where he became,
yeah,
and everyone was writing in Latin and reading Latin translations. And
yep.
I think, though, also it just points out the fact that psuche and anima, at least those mean the same thing more or less, but they don't really mean the same thing as soul. So if you just call it on the soul, then it's like you're distorting it right before even anybody reads the first words of it, because it's not about the soul in the Judeo-Christian sense of consciousness that, well, we may or may not have a soul. It really just, I read life force is another possible way of translating it. And Aristotle just takes it for granted that, of course, things have souls, because that's the question he's asking, is why are they alive? And why do they have a soul is just a way of asking, why are they alive?
What it is that makes them alive.
Yeah. It's the answer to the question of what makes them alive.
Yes. The difference between being dead and being alive is your soul.
But he does leave open the question of whether or not the soul can be separated,
yes,
from the body. I mean, at least a part of the soul, the intellect. For the most part, there's no soul without body. And You could see how he could be put to Judeo-Christian purposes as he was for hundreds of years.
Should it be called something like On the Life Force?
On the Animating Force? What makes us move?
Yeah.
I think just saying On the Force, I think, would be very timely. Yes.
No, on the Animator, really.
De-animator.
Exactly. Because that sort of fits in line with the way he talks to the whole book. These capacities, like the nutritive capacity.
And amazingly, Aristotle actually came up with midichlorians.
Oh, I was going to go there and you beat me to it.
Sorry, man. So we got three books in here. We're covering the first two this time. Book three is On the Intellectual Faculty. This book is known as really maybe the first book of psychology, at least focused psychology. And that's mostly book three. Though book two has a lot about perception. The breakdown is that the soul, as soon as he gets into it, book one is all just about how are we going to approach this sort of investigation? And here's what all of my predecessors thought about this. And we're not really going to talk about Empedocles or any of his predecessors, because in book two, he says, well, let's just shake that all off and start anew and actually tell you the right answer. And he breaks down the soul into the nutritive and generative. Those sort of go together, that all sorts of life has, even just plants. And then the perceptive faculty, and does he put perceptive and motive together? In other words, being able to move yourself? Seems like he puts those together. And those are also covered in book two. And then the intellectual seems restricted to just us. So are they three parts of the soul? Are they three kinds of souls? There's an initial interpretive issue. Are they different kinds of souls? Or they're just different faculties that the soul can have, right?
I mean, he starts off with that question about how to talk about the soul, right? The question of whether those are parts or whether they are potencies and whether they are separable or not separable. He's sort of constantly going back and forth on that in the structure of his inquiry. He doesn't think that they are separable, but he takes it up as a question.
So should we just get into the text and read some and talk about bits of it?
Yeah. I'm going to say that my role on this particular episode is going to be something like Mino. So I expect you guys to guide me to the knowledge of understanding of this that's already inside of me that I'm not aware of.
So it sounds like you had a similar reaction to what I did in reading this. I read this a couple of years ago to prep for a potential episode on this, and we ended up doing Aristotle's The Politics instead. But I really wanted to do something where we talked about teleology, which I thought this was kind of the source book for. It actually doesn't talk that much about teleology. Apparently, that's more in the physics and then in the stuff like the Nicomachean Ethics that we already read. But we get some of that here. And my impression at the time was, man, let's pretty much just read book three, because the rest of this is just a wasteland. It's just a bunch of terminology that is just so slow. And yet you read through a whole section like, was anything said there at all? But yet this is one of the texts that people that are into ancient philosophy love to spend a lot of time on. And so... Because
it's really not that. It's not what it seems. It's not empty generalizing and yeah.
I had to go over and over in this to have any of it stick to me. I ultimately got the LibriVox audio version and spun these first couple books multiple times until when I would look back at a passage like, oh, I remember that. And then I could... think of it more, whereas otherwise I would just immediately fall asleep is the way it was going. Like, let me start book one. Well, I'd pick it up a different day. Start book two. Sleep.
So, wow, Mark, you're selling this hard. I can tell.
Well, tell me your positive alternative reaction.
Well, I just never have had that reaction. I mean, ever since the first time I read it, I was completely engrossed. It was utterly captivating to me from the beginning.
I never appreciated it when I was younger. It's a lot better after you have some philosophy under your belt and when you're willing to take time with it, give it your attention. It's fascinating and it's such an alien way of looking at the world, but also really insightful. And then if you start reading commentaries, then you really start to get a sense of how badass it is.
Yeah. The edition I used was a Penguin edition, and it has a very long introduction, an introduction that's actually longer than the text. And then at the beginning of each chapter of each section, he does a summary of saying what's about to be said. And I can honestly say that I would not have been able to read this without that. And just like you, Wes, afterwards, I went out and found a line-by-line commentary, and I'm completely overmatched. Like, this is a seminar book. It's not a one-podcast book. or two podcast book for me, they're just layers upon layers upon layers. But it's so tightly organized, you just can't tell when you're reading the English because it sounds like you're getting a message from Cthulhu.
It was very evocative in that it made me want to like, well, why is he talking about potentiality and actuality like this? And so that made me go and read some of the Stanford Encyclopedia articles just on his overall biology, where I learned that he wrote all these other books about animals and the fact that he did zoological studies. So there's things backing up his biological observations, his very general observations here. And then the stuff about teleology and the stuff about what kind of investigation is he even doing? So it led me to read about what's in the works on logic, the prior analytics and the posterior analytics of what he considers an explanation. That's what's so weird here empirical inquiry is not foreign to him, but of course he's doing this way before Bacon and the scientific method. So though he's doing something scientific, there's still a lot of talks about it as a demonstrative method. And there are syllogisms involved in trying to find the middle term in things
Yeah, a lot of things that look almost like he's not doing anything but restating things are actually tight little proofs, basically. And
But certainly categorization is a lot of what he is about as a philosopher and here. And one of the things I read was questioning whether his description of the soul was really actually providing any explanation of it at all. It's the description of it as the first actuality. Is that the right term? Yes.
And this, Mark, I think answers your question. Why are we talking about potentiality and actuality when we're talking about the soul? And it's because the soul distinguishes dead things from living things, which are active and actualized in this very specific sense. So yeah, the soul will be a kind of realization or completion of something which turns out to be matter and or actualization. So, but go ahead with the first actuality. He gets to that very quickly after trying to define the soul at the very beginning of book two.
Well, I don't know if somebody wants to read a quote. I mean, my memory of it was just that, you know, the body is the kind of thing that is made to, and it's the question is not who made it or something, you know, that's sort of beside the point. The purpose of talking about teleology in general is you can talk about purposefulness without talking about a creator that did this with a certain purpose in mind. But just like the purpose of an eye is to see is a way of teleologically talking. So a body is something that has the potential to run around and eat and talk and things. And so then having a soul, maybe you're asleep. Maybe you're not actually doing those things. That would be the full actuality, the second level of actuality if you're actually exerting all those things. But just having a soul, whether you're actually doing those or not, is a, you could call it the second level of potentiality or the first level of actuality. I believe he uses both.
Yeah, the idea is that, for instance, you know, you could be ignorant of something or you could know it and not be actively using that knowledge or contemplating it, knowing it at a particular time. It could be latent. Or you could be actually using it or contemplating it. So the first actuality is a kind of potentiality. So this is one of the interesting things about Aristotle, is that it's, these are all relative terms. Something that's an actuality can also be a potentiality. And in fact, this idea that matter is potentiality, it can be used to make things, but it is also, so wood could be potentiality for an axe, but wood is also has form, right? So it's a structured thing with a form that's in a lower level material potentiality. But anyway, so the first actuality is just the possession of that knowledge and the capacity to use it, that sort of potentiality. And then the second actuality is actually using it.
Now, before we go any further with that, let's stop for a second and talk about our sponsor, The Great Courses. We are big fans of The Great Courses. We love learning about so many things at our own pace for the pure pleasure of it. And that's why we're excited about something new from The Great Courses. It's The Great Courses Plus Video Learning Service with unlimited access to thousands of fascinating subjects. The Great Courses Plus has nearly 5,000 video lectures in subjects like history, science, photography, cooking, of course, philosophy, and more, taught by award-winning professors and experts from National Geographic, the Smithsonian, and the Culinary Institute of America. With The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want at any time from anywhere on your TV, laptop, tablet, or phone. Partially examined listeners can get a new introductory offer to The Great Courses Plus free for 1 month.
The Great Courses lecture series are normally priced at $200 to $300 each, but now you can get unlimited access to the entire Great Courses Plus library, completely free for 1 month. So go sign up now for your free 1 month trial. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in a serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
Okay.
In this line-by-line commentary that I found, the commentator makes a good point of kind of laying out the problem statement that I think will help get at what Aristotle's trying to explain and will also help illuminate that idea of matter, Wes, that you just brought up.
Is this Eugene Gendlin, which is the one that comes up in search engines first?
Or
is
this Focusing.org?
It is, yes. University of Chicago, 2012.
Yeah, it's super helpful. So he brings into the conversation early on, he says, listen, you know, Aristotle's a categorizer, right? That's his thing. He says, if you think about the world or the universe, there's nature and then there's everything else. And what's in nature? Well, nature includes everything that happens, all of the things in the world that we think of as occurring naturally, like rocks and rivers and fish and trees and clouds and all that kind of thing. And then everything else is stuff like mathematical formulas or the laws of mathematics, but also created items, things that human beings make out of nature, but that aren't natural, like axes, right? So part of what Aristotle's concerned with is he says, I'm looking at the things in nature and I see we have things that are animated and things that are inanimate. So there's plants, animals, and human beings on one side, and there's rocks, maybe sand, I don't know, dirt, something else on the other side, right? And plants, animals, and human beings seem to be different. And what he's trying to figure out in this is to explain how it is that they are different. Even though they're both part of nature, even though they both have matter, as Wes said, and even created things that get made out of natural objects have a kind of matter, how are they different from those things? How are we and animals and plants different from those things? That really helped me frame the problem statement of the book.
Yeah. You know, he's on the track of saying it's going to have something to do with the kind of form they have.
So let's say more about what, this was another point of connection, that he talks about form and matter, kind of assuming that you know his metaphysical system a little bit. So say what this means exactly.
Well, he often talks about form and shape together. So you can think about it as simply the difference between what something is made of and then what structures it. So for any particular thing, what makes it a particular thing as opposed to just a undifferentiated, manifold, a soupy mess, is it has something formal about it. It's structured in some way that makes it a being that we can pick out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, form typically translates the word eidos.
Right.
So it's the what holds it together as a thing that you would pick out.
Yeah. So I always think of shape just because that's the easiest way to think of it. It's not always shape, of course, but if we think of, say, an axe handle that's been shaped to function as it does, the wood is the matter, and then the form is actually, in that case, well, you might think of it as the shape on the one hand, but then it also has something to do with its function.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of the axe, that's true, but I think you could even just say it's the arrangement such that it has an identity. You could even say, you know, if I have a whole bunch of, I don't know, pickup sticks and you throw them on the ground, you might pick out triplets of them that are overlapping and say, well, that's forming a triangle, or quadruples and saying, well, that's forming a square. And what are you doing when you say that? You're identifying them as a bunch of material that then has a form that has something that holds it together as a identifiable entity. And that's true exactly in the way that Wes is saying about the axe handle, is having a material, in this case of wood, that then has a form, a shape, that also serves a function. And that function is part of its form. It's part of what picks it out as what it is, as an axe handle.
Yeah, we could think of the formal as the properties, right? We could also think of this in terms of a...
And the function.
Of a substrate. Yeah, the function would be among the...
Properties,
yeah. The properties of the axe, the shape as well. And once, so there, I think we're already into complex territory.
Yes.
You know, the shape of an axe handle as a property versus the function as a property.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to point out is I like to think very simply of shape because it's the simplest example. But in many cases, we're not talking about something that's visible when we talk about the properties of a thing. So it's not just sensory properties that are formal. It's other types of properties as well.
And this distinction also cuts across, I was reading just to relate it to another bit of his metaphysics that people have hopefully heard of, is the different types of causation. So one of the types of causation is the material cause, which obviously is relevant to the matter. Another, though relevant to the matter, is the efficient cause. In other words, what actually is affecting it at that moment. And from what I understand, it's the whatness, it's the form that determines how the thing will react in the presence of the efficient cause. So an acorn doesn't just become a tree by itself. It still needs the efficient cause of water being poured on it and sunlight, all this stuff. But the fact that it grows into a tree is because of its form, which then is made up of the other two types of causation, one of which is just called the formal cause. And then the other is the final cause. So that gets at the distinction that Dylan and Wes were just making between the properties, which is like the form, and then the function, which is like the final cause. That's actually when teleology comes into it. So form has this sort of dual layer that, yes, it's just the shape of the thing, and the shape of it is going to determine what happens to it when something bumps into it, right? Is it going to slide forward? Is it going to go down? You know, if it's a triangle, it's going to bounce one way. If it's a circle, it's going to bounce another way. There's a very literal way you could take form. But then also form more abstractly determines if it's a complex thing like a living organism, what it's going to grow into, what it's going to tend toward, its function. I was just equating function with teleology. So basic elements are supposed to have very simple teleologies. This is part of his physics. So Earth, its teleology is it goes down, right? Air goes up. Would that be the function of Earth?
No, I don't.
Does that make sense?
No.
I mean, I think teleology is modeled on desire. Okay. So for instance, at some point he says, it's what you're directed to. We understand that in the case of our particular desires and intentions, we understand it perfectly. It's when you start attributing it to everything, including things that don't have desire, that it becomes this teleological theory. So he says at one point that generativity, I think, is for the sake of the eternal or reproductivity, so that it's a way of lasting even though particular individuals are dying. So it's a directedness mm-hmm. towards that goal, which we can think of on the model of desire. And I think Aristotle even speaks that way. He uses this term desire even in those contexts. Or we can think of the completion, which is, you know, another way of saying actuality, but the completion of a biological form, right? When it's grown from embryo all the way to its mature form, that mature form is the telos. That is the goal to which the organism was directed. So when we're talking about teleology, whether or not we want to think of it in terms of the model of desire or just some endpoint towards which a process is directed, that's the telos, and that's what we're talking about with teleology.
tie it back to the idea of the soul. Why are we talking about form versus matter? And
the soul is the form of the body.
And
bam.
Exactly.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. Sorry. We can stop now.
Well, he's reacting to these materialistic theories of the soul, right? Which he doesn't think are going to work.
You mean all that stuff in book one that we just said we were going to skip?
That I didn't read either. Yeah. But I knew that one sentence about it, so.
Yeah. So I guess we should summarize that. But it's not so hard. I don't know that we have to exactly go through all of those to understand the distinction he's making. In fact, in a lot of ways, it persists now, right? That the soul would be something that's super added onto the body, or that what you call soul is really just a bumping together of various parts of the body in some way. And he denies both of those things.
So he gets to this argument that the soul is not matter very quickly in book two. So 412a15.
Yep.
But since it is a body of a definite kind, viz. Having life, the body cannot be soul, for the body is not something predicated of a subject, but rather is itself to be regarded as a subject, that is, as matter. And the word for subject is really substrate, hupokaimenon, these property-bearing things.
In my translation, it says, but since it is a certain kind of body, one that has life, soul would not be the same as body. For body does not exist in an underlying thing, but rather as an underlying thing and as material. Soul then has to be a substantial thing as a form of a natural body that has life as its potency. But this kind of substantial being is being fully itself. This is the word entelecheia, which we'll talk about. So soul is the being fully itself of such a body.
And when he says the word body, by the way, he means this compound of
matter
and form, which is, you know, he starts out making his distinctions between matter, form, and the compound of the two. The body is the compound.
Yes.
The soul cannot just be that compound. It cannot be matter plus form, the body. It has to be something more.
Yeah.
Because it has to be predicable. It has to be of the body.
So isn't that weird that he's kind of making a substantial point for seemingly grammatical reasons?
Why do you call it grammatical?
Because of the word predicate?
Well, he's saying it's a property, right? So he's saying it has to be the property of the thing as opposed to just the thing. And why is he saying that?
Wait, say that again?
So it's not just a grammatical thing like, oh, this is predicable. It's a predicate of a subject. I mean, it's, you know, there's a corresponding grammatical point, but it's a real world point. He believes the soul has to be a property as opposed to a body. You can't point to a body and say, oh, that's the soul. This body out there is the soul.
You can't separate it and weigh it.
I mean, think of how strange that would be. You know, it's like, it would be like pointing the pineal gland and saying, that's the soul. It's just another body within the body. But I'm not sure he's made a specific argument beyond that.
So one of the things that I took away from this was that his issue with the materialist conceptions of the soul is that the way that he and his contemporaries and his predecessors thought about action or movement, there was a lot of disagreement about how things acted upon each other. And his primary concern, I thought, with these materialist conceptions of the soul is that if you thought of the soul as something like the body inside of the body, then you had problems explaining how the soul could make the body move, but then the soul would actually have to actually move as well. And also you had troubles explaining perception and the senses, how the outside world acted on the soul to create sensation or perception or ideas. That's what I got out of his criticisms in the commentary I read. So he's arguing against a materialist conception because materialism in his sense is thinking of the soul as a substance means that it has to have some kind of attributes that you can point to, but also that it has a kind of physical persistence that it's hard to explain.
Yeah, and in some ways, it harkens to the problem that you'd have with dualism in Descartes, right? That if a body is one thing and then the soul is something injected into it that's separate from it, you have this outstanding problem. Well, how does the soul communicate to the body and the body communicate to the soul unless they have some way of being the same sort of thing that can connect to one another? This is exactly the kind of language he uses about the problem of things that communicate to one another are things that are like one another, as opposed to being different from one another.
Yeah.
If we want to try and reconstruct this argument on the first page, bodies are preeminently substances, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this word substance is ousia in the ancient Greek. I'm not sure how to explain that right now. So they're preeminently substances because they're of natural origin. Other, you know, so everything. So for instance, an axe is not a natural body. An axe, and so even though it's made of natural things. Other things, so when he says they are the sources from which the rest are derived, these natural bodies, that's what he means. Then you say some of these natural bodies, a rock is a natural body, but so is an animal. So some have life and some do not have life. So I think here is where you're saying life is a property of some of these natural substances, but it's not a property of others. And in that sense, I think that's where you get this idea that the soul essentially has to be a property that distinguishes the living natural body from the non-living natural body. I think that's why he makes this point about something predicated of the subject. And that's where you get the idea that it's form as opposed to matter. So that's a really important step. So he's not just coming out and asserting that it's form with no argument. There is an argument here, even though I probably haven't done justice to it.
Well, there's at least an argument about why the soul can't be material, can't be substance in that way.
Well, except substance is form.
Sorry, it can't be matter. Sorry, maybe that's a more accurate way of saying it.
Yep.
Or maybe not. That's where it gets hard.
Yeah, substances are form and matter. So substances are the combinations.
But the distinction that at least Wes is referring to, I assume, Wes, you're referring to like around 412b15, that area?
I was just looking at the very first paragraph.
Of book two?
Yeah.
Yep. Of just having the three kinds of substantial being, the three ways of having substantial being, between being material and being shape or form and then being a composite?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And I misspoke when I said substances are compounds. Substances can be any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Substance can be just matter, it can be just form, or it can be the compound.
And we'll save that for our discussion of Aristotle's metaphysics in a future episode. I don't think that much hangs on the notion of substance here.
I mean, the identity that he's making is that he quickly moves to the fact that bodies are composite things. And then he wants to understand what he means by soul in the next couple paragraphs. And he wants to make the distinction of between artifacts or things that don't have internal motion, or the source of motion in itself.
A rock has a source of motion in itself in the sense that it'll fall downward if you pick it up and let go of it.
Yes.
And then animals have a source of motion in themselves in a different sense, right?
Exactly. And so a natural body which has a source of motion and rest in itself is what he's referring to as living things that have souls. That's the part of the inquiry that he's interested in.
Well, actually, yeah, even rocks, though, have the source of motion in themselves. And then the axe, even though it has that insofar as it's a material thing, insofar as it's an axe, it doesn't. So it has to be wielded by someone. Someone has to use it for chopping in order for it to do its, to be an axe. Yeah. So it doesn't have the motion in itself in that sense. Yeah.
Yes. It doesn't move itself. It doesn't move from place to place in itself. It doesn't generate itself. It doesn't change in itself. It doesn't grow and wither in itself.
Right. So living things have lots of functions as well, but they carry out their own functions. That's another way of putting it. The function of the axe is carried out externally. The reason why we were concentrating on substance a little bit, we were just trying to get at how he concludes the soul as a form. After that, he says that the soul is an actuality. Do we know why he thinks of it as an actuality?
It seems to follow just by the definition of what actuality is, which I gave earlier, which is that it is fulfilling its function. It's if you're asking if soul is defined right at the beginning, we're not investigating exactly what the soul is. This inquiry is about the whatness of the soul, about what the soul is. But we start with the bare minimum that it is the thing that makes something alive, whatever that means. The being alive is the actuality.
Yeah. So once we say it's the form of the body, and the whole point of the form is to give life, then it takes this thing that potentially has life and it completes it. I like the word. So for actuality, again, it translates into lekeia.
Yeah.
And I like the word completion, this idea that the soul, in a sense, completes the potentially living thing to make it living. It brings it to this end, this completion.
There's a nice definition in at the end of the in the glossary for the translation I have, which is very common to the kinds of definitions you'll have. One thing to note is the word entelecheia is Aristotle coins this word by taking entelecheia, persistence or continuity, and sticking telos and final cause into the middle of it. It might most literally be translated as persisting in completeness. It denotes a thing's active self-sustaining as what it is. I mean, that's a lot more words to when we use actuality, or Wes, you were saying, you didn't say persisting to completeness, but you said completing.
Or completion, just, yeah. So we could say actuality and completion, yeah.
Dylan, I thought your translation had like being at work or something like that for actuality. Is that right?
The translation that he uses for entelechia is being fully itself.
Yeah, the being at work is more like the energeia, which is what yes. probably is translated as activities later on. And it is, in some cases, yeah, intimately associated with actuality. But that actually brings us to this distinction he makes here that you started with, Mark, between first and second actuality. Because a first actuality is not an activity, right? The having of, it's a potentiality, the having of knowledge that I might use. And then the second actuality is an energeia. It's an activity using that knowledge or contemplating, let's say.
Yeah. And the reason why, you know, this guy is going to translate it as being fully itself or being at work is he wants to preserve this activity nature, this ongoing motion in Aristotle, whereas the word actuality, the way we've been talking about it is kind of completeness. There's some aspect of there being activity involved with it, but he's trying to highlight that notion of action going on all the time.
Yeah.
There's another aspect to it, which is particularity. So you can think of actuality as being this particular actual concrete thing doing this actual concrete action, whereas this notion of potentiality is a could be this, a could be that, but the actuality is the realization in an actual concrete particular instance.
You know, when we don't want to just talk about soul and the realization or actuality of it in some kind of abstract terms, but we would be talking about the activity of a particular animal, a particular person, or a particular tree, and their particular flourishing. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yep.
Part of his conversation, he's asking, does the soul have parts or is it a whole? And is the soul a general or universal thing or is it a particular thing? And I think it's really important that we talk about if Seth has a soul, that's a big if, Seth's soul and Dylan's soul, it's the actualization of Dylan as Dylan and the actualization of Seth as Seth.
Yeah, so it's like identity in that respect, right?
In the sense that it has particularity, yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
So then he says that the soul is the first actuality. So this is at 412b.
If then we have to give a general formula applicable to all kinds of soul, we must describe it as the first grade of actuality of a natural, organized body.
Right.
That is why we can wholly dismiss as unnecessary the question whether the soul and the body are one. It is as meaningless as to ask whether the wax and the shape given to it by the stamp are one, or generally the matter of a thing and that of which it is the matter.
I think the point of saying it's a first actuality, right, is that it possesses all these functions, and those functions, the reason why he talks about organs here is those functions are associated with organs. You know, we'll get to the senses later and nutrition and things like that. So even when they are not turned on, right, even though when they are not active, they still have a sort of actuality to it. They're first actualities in the sense that they have that functional structure that would allow them to do what they're designed to do when they are turned on. You don't have to be sensing things for the eye to be a first actuality, to be an organ that is a first actuality.
When it says soul is the first actuality of a natural body, is there anything after that? In mine, it says soul is the first being fully itself, the first actuality of a natural body that has life as its potency.
But ours is possessed of organs.
Such a body would be one with organs.
So mine was just the first grade of actuality of a natural organized body.
It's somatos fusiku organiku. He is using it as, you know, like organic, as in you could translate it as organized or having organs. But so it's an organized natural body or a natural body with organs, however you want to put it.
Yeah, okay.
Makes you think a little more about that term organized. I got to get organized. I got to get some organs.
Well, Mark, that's profound.
Makes it...
You get Hammond organs?
A lot more disgusting. Yes.
But I like this whole wax and impression thing. That's sort of a... This idea of the inseparability of the soul from the body and sort of really concretely illustrating the point you made, Mark, early on, which is that when we think of the soul, we're not thinking of this separable metaphysical substance that goes to heaven after the body disappears. It's as close to the body as an imprint is to wax.
So we could think about, if we feel like for our next episode covering book three is too light, adding Plato's Phaedo.
No, to the absolutely mix. Not.
No?
Are you freaking crazy? We've gotten through like two paragraphs of this so far. If you want to do another episode on the Phaedo, that's fine. I think that's totally sensible.
The context in which I bring it up is merely because from what I read, Aristotle was pitching himself as cleaving to the middle way between folks like Plato, who give in the Phaedo many arguments for why the soul is distinct from the body, why the soul is immortal, really, so therefore distinct from the body, and the materialists that he's objecting to. So he's presenting this middle way, though he says, well, maybe the intellect seems, and we can talk about the passages where he says this, comes up more in book three, maybe the intellect could be separable. But for the rest of this, given that soul includes things like the nutritive capacity and, you know, it is the form of the organism. So no, it's not separable. And this sounds very modern, though, as we were saying, it was appropriated by Christianity that fixated on the, no, the intellect is separable. The soul can be immortal. But quite a lot of this just reads like, you know, of course life, why would you assume that life is a ghost that goes into a body and therefore walks away when it dies? Why wouldn't you just think of it by actually looking at a living body and thinking of that life, the soul, is something the body does. It's a functional part of the organism.
Well, Mark, now that you're mentioning function, we could move on to the next page where
yes,
he talks about, this is really interesting, he talks about the soul, and I'm actually unclear about how he makes this transition, but in 412b, he calls the soul a substance in the sense of a formula. A formula is translating logos.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it essence of such and such a body. And here, you know, I said before, essence is ousia. So unfortunately, translations will also translate another phrase as essence. And it is toti ein einai, which is the what it is to be. So the soul is the what it is to be. It is, you know, what is it to be the body? What is it to be the living body? It is the soul.
My translator says, it is the substantial being that is a thing's logos, or the being what it is of a certain kind of body, which is pretty literal compared to what you just said.
Yeah.
I believe the LibriVox version, which is the R.D. Hicks version, used quiddity.
Oh my God.
The whatness.
The whatness.
That's what quiddity means. I mean, it's it being what it is.
The toti tni is a, there's like paragraphs and pages of commentary you can have just on that thing.
Yeah. So, but it's just a, it's a good indication of some of the sort of down-to-earthness and simplicity of Aristotle's language as opposed to the way it sometimes gets translated. But then we move on. If you want to know what it, to expand on this toti ein einai, we get the axe and the eye example.
But you should say a little bit more about that, Wes. I mean, if there's one thing I found in trying to read some Aristotle in Greek, it was this kind of thing where there are what amount to very straightforward questions where they end up being coming down. So the what it is to be.
Well, he's thinking on analogy to definition, right? And he even begins that whole sentence with, we've given a general definition. But here it's not simply semantic, it's real definition. So if you say, what is it to be a dog? And then you give some sort of definition, some criteria to define the concept. For Aristotle, you can do that in the real world. So when you say, what is it to be a living body? And you say, well, the soul. And then the question of how you think about that, whether you're thinking about it as an efficient cause or final cause or formal cause, actually it turns out to be all three. It's just not a material cause. And then you have to spell that out, what makes it a real definition as opposed to something simply semantic. And I think you have to start talking about mechanism there and probably more than that, given the way Aristotle approaches things. But so the soul, in a way, it's something like the property. Yeah, I should stop repeating that, but...
Well, I guess, I mean, you're giving a good example since we're bringing up every little well-known element of Aristotle's metaphysics is, you know, what are essences, that essences seem weird. And if you read Plato, they seem weirder, but it's just really when you look into a natural body, you find that there are certain things that it has a nature. It has a thing that makes it what it is. And there you go. There's nothing mysterious about that unless you, you know, are entirely a cultural relativist, or you might just deny that such things exist. It's just the way different languages and different cultures pick things out. There's no essences, but he thinks that that's just what an honest appraisal of the world gives you.
Yeah. So right around where Wes is referring us to when he says a substantial thing is the thing's logos, the what it is of a certain kind of body. It is just as if some tool were a natural body, for example, an axe. Then what it is to be an axe would be its substantial being, and this would be its soul. Bereft of this, it would no longer be an axe except in name. On the other hand, this is only an axe. The soul is not in fact the logos and the being of what it is, this kind of thing, but rather of a natural body, which has its source of motion and rest in itself.
Yeah, so this gets us again to the, suppose an axe had its motion itself and it could perform its own function. It could cut things by itself, running around, performing that function. Then we would think of the soul as that the thing, you know, it's animated now, right? Since it's running around by itself, but it's animated in a particular way. It's animated according to a particular functional scheme of cutting. That's why we want to think of this in terms of function and why he brings up the axe and the eye.
For this episode, should I, instead of having someone just using the Aristotle picture, have someone draw a cartoon picture of an axe with legs running around?
Absolutely.
Yes, definitely. Well, one of the things that I read in the commentary that was very illuminating was, because that's a hard passage in some senses to understand, but when he says it would just be an axe in name, the guy who did the line-by-line commentary says, think of an animal. When it's dead, you might say, oh, say a dog. You know, that's a dog, but it's a dog in name only because the life force that allowed it to run around and do things and jump and fetch and all that stuff is gone. But you know that that was once there. There was a point in time that thing had that ability to be self-motivated in that way. And an axe doesn't have that, and it never had that. And so in a sense, an axe is the same as a dead animal or person, but in another way, it's not quite the same thing because the axe never had the potentiality. It could never have been self-motivated in that way.
The dead animal has something missing, whereas the axe doesn't have anything missing.
Perfectly put. Thank you for saying it.
So another way of putting this, if the eye were a living creature, its soul would be its vision.
Yes.
Which is weird.
If the vision fails, there is no eye, except in an equivocal sense.
Vision is the function of the eye.
Yeah. And it would be, you know, of course, he doesn't think vision is the soul of the eye. He's saying if it were a living creature.
Yeah. And if this is lost, it is no longer an eye except in name, like a stone eye or an eye in a painting, right? So if the eye were a living creature and it were to become blind, then it's like a living creature that became dead. It's no longer an eye except in name, just like the dead dog is no longer a dog except in name.
Because it lost its function. So the living is the function of the
yes,
whole being.
Yes, the living is the function.
The living is the function.
And then there are all these sort of sub-functions, right? You know, generation, nutrition, sensation, all of those serve the higher function of living.
What's weird about this, I think, to modern readers, to me at least, is the first question on kicking this whole inquiry off is, what is the thing that makes something alive? And makes sounds like cause, which sounds like what Aristotle would call efficient cause. In other words, what is the actual mechanism by which something is alive as opposed to not alive? But that's not really what he means.
No.
So according to this commentary, these chapters within Book 2 go efficient cause. So the soul is efficient cause. And that's actually what this chapter is focused on, the soul as efficient cause. And it is also formal and final cause. I can't say I fully understand it, but...
But that example... The axe-ness of the animated axe, or the vision of the eye that is running around as its own independent animal, that's a characterization of the kind of thing that it does, but it is not an efficient cause. It is not the muscles that make the eye see or whatever. It's not the mechanism.
Yeah, it's not what we would typically think of as an efficient cause.
Well, but I think that Aristotle is going to say that the soul is, I mean, I hadn't thought of it as that section as being about the soul as efficient cause, but it sort of makes sense to me in that the soul is the animating form of the body. So when an animal is moving around, when an animal is growing, that's part of the activity of their soul. Their soul is responsible for that.
Yeah, you can't move around without a soul. You have to have that. Yeah.
Yes, and this is the way in which it becomes a little bit more the soul. You know, Wes just pointed to the soul as having this multiple participating in multiple causes. It also, on the one hand, you have parts of the soul that are in some sense souls themselves. You have the nutritive soul, the generative soul, the locomotive soul, but they are subsumed under the soul of the whole entity, which includes intellect. For certain kinds of animals, those certain kinds of animals are just us. So in that way, it's confusing in the sense that you're using a term that's referring to the whole thing as well as parts of the thing.
Yeah, and also the way we would think of efficient causes, we would think like, you know, the way Mark is thinking of atoms interacting and then chemical interactions and then other causal stuff. That's all the efficient cause stuff. And then if we did want to say there's a soul, we would see that as like a supervenience, right? Something supervening on all that efficient causality. It is weird, I think, for us to say, no, it's not simply this supervenient thing. It is the cause that makes the thing alive. It's not all just reducible to the chemical interaction, even though those are important and Aristotle's actually concerned with those. But
well, just the way you described it, that you've got all these efficient causes, but there are so many of them that if you talk about the form as being the structure of those many little movements of efficient cause, then you could say as a shorthand, yeah, the form is actually the thing that's animating.
Yeah, good point.
Even though form really, as you introduced it, just means shape. Well, how does a shape animate something? Well, if the shape is really intricate and, you know, it's just like a think of an appliance, like it's the form, meaning how all the little bits of electronics and mechanical components are
work together. Yeah.
Put into themselves. It still needs an efficient cause. It needs the electricity to go into it, but it's the form that makes it animate the way it does. It makes it fulfill its function as a blender or whatever.
Right.
But is that not the way? Because that sounds like that's exactly supervenient. It's just a different way of describing the same. Supervenient means we shouldn't just throw that term out because that's going to be a very confusing term. And I think it's very hard for me to unpack right here. But the way I was interpreting that is a different level of explanation. Or would that just be nominal supervenience and you mean metaphysical supervenience or something?
Well, I think supervenience would be, yeah, like some higher level phenomena that's predicated on these lower level phenomena, but isn't necessarily itself causal. So I was thinking you might think the properties of water, clearness, and the other properties supervene on the molecular structure. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not sure actually that's because it's been so long. I'm not sure if that's a great example.
Well, that's the problem with supervene is it's usually brought up only in terms of phenomenal qualities, that the consciousness supervenes on the brain and the phenomenal water supervenes on the chemical water. And so when you get out of the context of consciousness, then what does supervene mean?
Well, just in this case, this idea of a, you know, we have a sort of gestalt sense of what it means for something to be animated. And that's mm-hmm. So we could see that as a kind of property. But some level, we might think, well, that's just reducible to all these efficient scientific causes and couldn't itself be causal. But I think, mm-hmm. Mark, your example was a good one of wrapping our heads around what Aristotle might mean by it being an efficient cause. But we probably shouldn't belabor that because we got that out of the commentary and it's not explicit yet, at least, that he's talking about that here. But it's good to have in mind.
All right, so that is the end of part one of the first of two discussions we'll be having on De Anima. We've tried to say a lot about what his whole project is, what life is. Tune in next week for the next installment where we'll get more into plants, the nutritive faculty, and animals who have the perceptive faculty, in contradistinction to Plato, who thought that perception requires judgment, i.e. intellect. Aristotle seems to have a more animal-friendly doctrine whereby the faculties of perception and even imagination do not require intellect, which is specifically human, and the subject of Book 3, which we are not going to get into until Episode 131, 2 weeks from now. But in Part 2 of the current discussion, we're still going to grapple a little more with the different types of causation and what Aristotle means by forms. So how is the soul the cause of the living body? You may want to brush up before next week on the Greek term logos by listening to our Heraclitus discussion from episode number 79. And if you don't want to wait for part 2 of this discussion, episode 130, you don't have to. Both these parts are really just one discussion that took place in one sitting, and it's probably best to listen to it that way. If you become a Partially Examined Life citizen, for a mere $5 you can get the Citizen Edition, which is the unbroken, ad-free version of the episode. That will also give you the ability to take part in the very probable, but still tentative at this point, after show that we're going to have on De Anima. So listeners can get involved and have a discussion with us about what all this really means and why we should care about it. And what better New Year's resolution could you make to yourself than to read some philosophy yourself and engage in the kind of discussions that we engage in here with other Partially Examined Life listeners that'll help you make sure that you understand, that'll give you the benefit of your peers' understanding. And with Partially Examined Life citizenship, you'll have access to our entire not school infrastructure. In fact, it's not too late for you to propose a reading group for January. Or you can join one of the existing groups. Our mayor of Not School, Nathan Hanks, is going to tell you in just a minute what proposals are currently on the table. Before he does that, I also want to remind you that we have many copies left of our 2016 Partially Examined Life wall calendar, which looks really damn sweet. Full 12-inch by 12-inch, better than last year's. You can go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store to pick one up. Thanks as always for listening, and thanks for your support.
Hey everyone, this is Nathan Hanks, and I have a few new updates from our Not School and Citizens Forum. Members are now looking to start new groups in January, and they have these proposals: Intro to Analytic Philosophy, French Theory by Francois Cassette, Homo Sacer by Giorgio Agamben, chapters 4 through 8, and Contingency, Hegemony, and Universality, chapter 5. If you're interested in these groups, go to the Citizens Forum and check them out. You can chime in and get this thing going with other members. If you have any questions about Not School, just contact me. That's Nathan at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks for listening, and have a happy new year.